proud of our long history and glad that we were able to survive this ordeal of the past year and make it to the 30th year.
The Kuskokwim 300 will celebrate 30 years of racing this winter. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 7th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, looking at what Ted Stevens may face if he prevails through the vote count.
Most senators, when they get into this kind of trouble, at some point will resign, usually under pressure from the party.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
An attorney for plaintiffs in the Exxon Valdez lawsuit says federal court judge Russell Holland could have a decision on a punitive damages allocation plan by the end of next week. Holland heard oral arguments Wednesday in an appeal of the current allocation plan. A former Prince William Sound fish processor, Seahawk Seafoods of Valdez, filed last month for a larger share of the $507 million settlement. If the judge approves the appeal, all parties would have to negotiate a new allocation plan, a process that took years the first time. Plaintiff's attorney David Esting says he's confident the judge will deny Seahawk's claim. Esting says Holland promised to decide by November 15th. Alaskans likely won't know for another week who has won the race for its U.S. Senate seat, incumbent Republican Ted Stevens, or the challenger, Democratic Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich. But Washington, D.C. is buzzing with speculation about what will happen if Stevens is returned to office. Now that he's a convicted felon, his fellow senators have threatened to expel him from their ranks. From Washington, APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Only five sitting senators have ever been convicted of felony crimes, including Senator Stevens. In an Alaska public broadcasting debate last week, Stevens defended himself.
I'm not going to step down. I have not been convicted. I have got a case pending against me.
Although Stevens has not yet been sentenced, he was convicted last month of seven felonies. And in the eyes of those who govern Washington, D.C., he may be a target for expulsion from office. As the dust clears from the election, time will tell how serious the senator's threats were. But just how unusual is the situation?
In general, it's not common to have convicted people in office.
Julian Zelizer is a professor at Princeton University and an expert in congressional history. He says of the Senate's four prior convicted felons, two resigned, one's term expired, and the other died. None stayed in office long enough to get kicked out.
Most senators, when they get into this kind of trouble, at some point will resign, usually under pressure from the party.
The Senate can expel a member with a two-thirds vote, but that's very rare and hasn't been done in 146 years. Most expulsion cases date back to the Civil War and involve Confederates. In recent decades, the Senate was prepared to kick out New Jersey Democrat Harrison Williams in the 1980s for his conviction of conspiracy and bribery in a sting operation. And in the 1990s, the Senate's Ethics Committee recommended expelling Oregon Republican Bob Packwood for sexual misconduct and abuse of power. Both Packwood and Williams chose to resign. But Professor Zelizer notes that's not really Stevens' style.
Behind the scenes, I'm sure there has been a lot of pressure on Stevens. The thing with Stevens is he's pretty tough and he's pretty determined. And his strategy has been to fight the charges. And in the campaign itself, he almost tried to turn the charges into an asset to say, look, they're out to get me. Don't let them do that. And so far, he hasn't buckled under the pressure I'm sure Republicans are putting on him.
Zelizer says in Washington, much is done behind the scenes in backroom bargaining. But if that doesn't work, senators may again begin speaking out about getting rid of Stevens.
That's usually when they move to expel someone, if privately they can't achieve what they want to do. And the person who is the source of the problem is refusing to compromise. That could actually lead them to use this constitutional power, which, again, they usually don't want to do.
Zelizer says if Alaska's voters end up reelecting Stevens, the Senate will have to weigh that very carefully because the voice of the American people counts for a lot.
That said, you know, this is a major problem for the Republican Party. They're kind of a party on the outs right now, and they've been struggling with the issue of corruption for a while now. It's been, I think, one of the key themes that have helped bring them down from power since the Jack Abramoff stories in 2006. So it's a huge liability for a Republican Party trying to rebuild itself to have this senator who's at least now guilty of very serious ethics charges.
In an editorial this week, the New York Times called for Stevens to be kicked out this month during an upcoming lame duck session. The question may be how much momentum that opinion gathers in coming weeks. Zelizer says Stevens faces an uphill battle.
There's not a lot of good feeling for Senator Stevens in the Republican Party right now. So I think the pressure on him will increase.
If Stevens does not prevail in this month's election, the point may be moot. The Senate will likely allow him to retire gracefully and finish up his term. But if Alaska's veteran senator defies the odds and is reelected, what happens next may make history. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Organizers with the Kuskokwim 300 say they're on track for a successful season of dog racing after a rough ride this year. The K300 has been short of cash since the arrest of their former race manager last spring. But thanks to some penny pinching and a little help from their friends, organizers say the 30th anniversary of the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race will go on. From member station KYUK, Shane Iverson reports.
Dog aficionados can mark their calendars. The first K300-sponsored race is set for December 27th, says race manager Myron Angstman. It's called the Holiday Classic.
It's usually around 45 miles, and it's always been a popular event. There's no entry fee, and we'll determine the purse here in a little while. In most years, it's about $5,000.
And from there, it's on to the main event, the Kuskokwim 300 race, and its sister races, the Bogus Creek 150 and the Akiak Dash. They're set to begin Friday, January 16th. The first K300 was organized in 1978. This year will be the 30th running.
That's a significant number of years to be putting on an event like this, and we're proud of our long history and glad that we were able to survive this ordeal of the past year and make it to the 30th year.
Earlier this year, the K300's former race manager, Stacy Gilliland, was arrested and charged with stealing from the organization. She is currently pleading not guilty, but her defense has announced they hope to change that plea as part of a deal. Angstman said if Gilliland is found guilty, they will try to recoup some of the money she allegedly took.
We will have an opportunity to show what our damages are, and that will be determined by the court.
In the meanwhile, he says it's already been a difficult path for the race to navigate.
We started at a bad spot this year. We were really completely out of money and owed money last March 1st, but we've regrouped, and there are a number of factors that have allowed us to get back on our feet, and everything looks good at this point.
The K300 board zeroed out staff funding, sold their truck, and dropped phone and internet services. They also went without liability insurance for a small period. To help generate some quick revenue, Angstman said they contacted the donors the race relies on heavily.
We've contacted those folks earlier than we have in other years, and the response has been good, so everything is looking very promising right now.
The K300 draws the thickest concentration of top-level dog racers of any race, in no small part to the generous purse that they dole out. The winner can earn $20,000.
I would expect that the purses are going to remain the same from last year.
In order to generate additional revenue, the K300 also initiated a mileage drive where donors could buy a mile of the race. Angstman says about 70 miles have been purchased so far. With some money at hand, the K300 has been able to hire a part-time assistant. And there's some financial assistance for those that won a race during the K300 weekend. The Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation Diabetes Prevention will again be paying entrance fees for anyone racing that weekend as long as they're from the YK Delta. I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, ramping up training for new projects in Alaska.
They want to go to work. They're happy to go to work. Everyone knows each other. It's not like you get thrown out there and you don't know anybody and it's a strange new world.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
A labor union nonprofit group is expanding a pipeline training center in Fairbanks. Alaska Works, a partnership of unions like the Teamsters and Pipefitters and the oil industry, formed a decade ago to train workers for the North Slope. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the group, which has trained more than 700 workers, had been operating on borrowed real estate until this fall.
Government, union, and oil industry officials gathered to dedicate the new site of the Alaska Works Partnership Fairbanks Pipeline Training Center. The 50-plus acre lot in South Fairbanks was recently donated to the group by the North Star Borough. Officials looked on as over 100 students graduated from the latest two-week training session held at the new site. Alaska Works Superintendent Danny Parrish says the sprawling outdoor operation offers North Slope pipeline-specific heavy equipment, construction, welding, and safety training not available anywhere else.
It is unique to pipelining where all crafts work basically together, where if you have an apprenticeship school for some trades that's specific to that trade, they get good instruction on certain things, but they never get the opportunity really to work with each other and learn how the other crafts work. And so here on this site, they all get to work together.
Parrish points to the worksite-like operation where students actually build small-scale pipelines. The training center employs 25 former North Slope workers as instructors and benefits from donations of heavy equipment, tools, materials, and fuel from the construction and oil industry. Jim Leidy with the Pipefitters Union in Fairbanks says most students who take advantage of the free training get jobs after graduation.
Over the last, at least the last 3 years, we tracked that. Everybody that went through had an opportunity to go on the North Slope. Most did. And a lot of these same craft people that go to work on this North Slope job in the first quarter of the year are on projects for, you know, in the Alyeska system in the summer months. And so the skills that they get are directly transferable to other projects.
A major focus of the Alaska Works program is training rural Alaskans for pipeline jobs. The group holds screening sessions in villages to select students who then travel to Fairbanks to attend training. Superintendent Danny Parrish says the experience can be transformative.
They actually become members of an elite group of people that, you know, they can be proud. They want to go to work. They're happy to go to work. Everyone knows each other. It's not like you get thrown out there and you don't know anybody, and it's a strange new world, you know. We got a lot of guys that just have turned out really well, and they're just, you know, it's like they come out of their shell, you know. It's really a good deal.
Parrish says the Pipeline Training Center works with a range of skill levels, from young kids just breaking into the trades to journeymen wanting to upgrade their skills. Some students log regular stints at the center as part of multi-year union apprenticeship programs. Alaska Works has plans to grow the outdoor facility with classroom, shop, and dorm buildings in the near future. Parrish anticipates continued demand at the training center due to a shortage of skilled workers in Alaska and a range of upcoming pipeline projects, including future construction of a North Slope natural gas line. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Air Force investigators say toxicology reports found alcohol but no drugs in Brigadier General Thomas L. Tinsley, who took his own life in July. Tinsley was commander at Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage. Air Force officials say the investigation is consistent with their initial assessment that he died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Investigators say they did not find a suicide note nor any indication that Tinsley planned his death. They say Tinsley had no financial troubles or other issues to indicate a suicidal motive. In a statement released by the Air Force today, General Howie Chandler calls Tinsley a remarkable officer with a reputation for excellence. Tinsley's family also released a statement saying the results gave them no better understanding of his death. Convicted murderer Cress Kearney was sentenced to 104 years in prison without the possibility of parole in Dillingham Superior Court yesterday. Kearney was convicted in April of the 2006 murder of Dillingham mother of four, Natalia Tamurphy. From KDLG in Dillingham, Eileen Good has more.
Natalia Timurphy first went missing in early September of 2006. 3 weeks later, her strangled body was found in a gravel pit near the Nurka subdivision in Dillingham. In November of 2006, Cress Carney initially confessed to that murder, claiming he had killed Timurphy because he feared she would accuse him of a sex crime. Defense counsel attempted unsuccessfully to have that confession suppressed for trial, and argued during trial that it was forced out of him by coercive police tactics. The jury did not find that argument compelling, and convicted Carney last April of first and second degree murder and tampering with a crime scene. Prior to handing down his sentence yesterday, Judge Fred Terese heard from many witnesses, including Cress Carney's father, Natalia Timurphy's aunt, and the guardian of Natalia Timurphy's children, as well as from counsel in the case and Cress Carney himself. The district attorney's office asked for a maximum sentence, including 99 years imprisonment, to be served consecutively with a 5-year penalty for tampering with a crime scene. Assistant District Attorney Ben Hoffmeister additionally asked the judge to remove the possibility of discretionary parole, noting that Carney is dangerous today and will still be dangerous at the age of 75. Carney's attorney, Scott Sterling, asked for a moderate amount of leniency in the case, noting that while Carney is certainly a criminal, he is not a monster.
But Cress did confess to killing Natalia. The tape, at least my belief is, made the impression on the jury that Cress was confessing to something that he needed to confess to. And that shows that he has a conscience. And that shows that he's not a monster. Judge, I have no doubt that the court is going to agree that an extended period of isolation is going to be the primary sentencing criteria along with community condemnation. I'm not going to try and dissuade the court from avoiding or incorporating those criteria. But I am going to suggest this, that when the sentence is imposed, it should be for a period of time without parole restriction that allows this gentleman, when he is of a certain age, which I predict will be in his mid to late 70s or his mid to late 80s, to at least allow him to present himself to the parole board.
Speaking on his own behalf, Carney's sentiments to the judge were somewhat muddled, sounding at times repentant, but at other times highly resentful.
If there was a chance I did it, and this was a better trial, the state had evidence, I would admit to it, Your Honor. I'd straight up admit to it. I'll tell you, Your Honor, give me the 99. I committed a crime, give me the 99. Don't give me the parole. Give me the whole 99, because I know even if within you give me 99, I'll be eligible for parole in 33 years. I know the parole board ain't getting it because of my past record, ain't give me parole. So I'm going to die in prison anyway. I did find the Lord, and he, you know, I prayed about this law. And yes, I might have committed the murder. I ain't saying I did, I ain't saying I didn't. I got a good chance of getting this on appeal. And for the family members here today, they don't have to worry about me sticking around this cop-calling town.
In the end, the prosecution got the sentence they requested. When handing down his sentence, the judge noted the brutality and premeditated nature of Carney's crimes, as well as the harm Mr. Carney's actions had done to the community as a whole. In view of those things, Terese said, there was no option but to treat Carney as a worst offender, and as such sentenced him to 99 years in prison to be served consecutively with a 5-year sentence for crime scene tampering. He also revoked the possibility of discretionary parole. For Hoffmeister's part, he says while this result does not make him happy, he does believe justice has been served.
I don't take sentencing lightly. It's something that I put a lot of thought and effort into, and I think that the judge said that he does the same thing. I think anyone that does my job that thinks that it's a very easy thing to do to sentence someone basically to the rest of their life in jail is somewhat foolish. It's a very difficult thing to do, and it's a recommendation that I take very seriously. That being said, it's not something that I envy. But in this particular case, I think it was necessary. So how I feel, I think that justice was served, and I think that the public is protected from a very dangerous offender, a person that needs to remain permanently isolated, I think is what I told them, the court and what the court agreed with. So.
Carney's attorney has said he will likely pursue a further appeal. In Dillingham, I'm Eileen Good.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the new AT&T, your world delivered.
This week on AK, new beginnings, from a new president to a new restaurant to a new job, as a stay-at-home dad, that and more coming up on AK from APRN.
Kodiak is a diverse place, and many residents take a winding road to get there. Perhaps no one has had a longer journey than Kodiak City Councilman Gabriel Saravia, who's gone from being an illegal immigrant to having a seat on the city's ruling body. Casey Kelly has more.
Gabriel Saravia first came to the United States in 1978, a 16-year-old kid with a second-grade education.
Well, I was born in La Moncada, Guanajuato, Mexico. And I come to the United States in the time I'm 16 years old. I cross the border, illegal alien, and come into Indiana and work in the farms for almost 3 years, from the time I'm 16 years old to the time I'm 19.
He read a newspaper article in Indiana that said there was a lot of work in Alaska, so in April 1981, he packed his things and boarded a plane to Juneau.
And I stay in Juneau for 2 days, and I don't find no work, and I buy a ticket to go to Anchorage and I stay for 2 days, and I don't find no work, and I buy a, somebody say they have a lot of fish and work in Kodiak, and I buy a ticket to come to Kodiak, and I arrive at Kodiak April 11, 1981, and I start working in Western Alaska fisheries, cleaning fish for $5.80 an hour in the line.
Saravia has worked at Western Alaska Fisheries ever since. He's now the personnel and production manager at the plant and says the company has treated him well. He says it was a lot easier in the late 70s and early 80s for an illegal immigrant to find work.
And in 1981, the time I come to Alaska, I'm still illegal. But in that time, you only have to say I'm American citizen, and that's immigration's problem. They prove you that you're not. Not you, they prove them that you are. Right now, after the law changed, you have to prove them that you're American citizen. I get the amnesty for Ronald Reagan in 1986, and I got my green card in 1986, or permit for work, and I become an American citizen in 1992.
He says becoming an American citizen is one of the proudest moments of his life.
This is the country of the opportunities, and I think I owe everything what I have and what I am to United States of America, and I feel that's my country. I still love Mexico, and I go visit them, but I love Kodiak.
He credits Kodiak Mayor Carolyn Floyd and her husband Joe for helping him out along the way. She was the one who urged him to get his GED at Kodiak College and later told him that he should run for the city council.
Carolyn Floyd is, I know them for a long time because of the cultural events and everything else. He's pushing me to run for city council for many, many years, you know. And I said, well, my kids are too small. I work in by hourly. I don't have no time. I need to work and everything. And finally, 5 years ago, they convinced me to run.
Mayor Floyd says she's proud of all that Saravia has accomplished.
He came here with less than a high school education, and yet he stepped forward and attended classes and got his GED, which is the high school equivalency diploma, and I'm very proud of him for doing that.
She adds that he represents an important demographic in Kodiak's diverse community.
When I met him, I knew he would be a great addition and representative of that group, of the Hispanic group on our council, and we need that because there's a large group of Hispanics, Mexican Hispanics that live in our community.
Saravia says he's proud to represent all the citizens of Kodiak, regardless of race or background. The most important thing to him, he says, is making sure Kodiak's economy stays strong and there's enough work in the local canneries for everyone who wants a job. For the past year, Saravia has served as the city's deputy mayor, representing the city at events and running meetings when Mayor Floyd is out of town. He says he hasn't decided yet whether he'll seek a third term on the council when his current tenure ends next year, but he plans to stay active in the community, and the 46-year-old says he has no plans to retire from his job at Western. I'm Casey Kelly.
The Board of Trustees of Sheldon Jackson College reaffirmed their goals this week of satisfying the college's $13 million debt and maintaining the core campus as a training, education, and Alaska Native cultural center. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
The Board of Trustees says it can satisfy the $13 million debt by selling off perimeter properties, tentatively valued at $14.7 million. In order to sell those properties, the master plat must first be approved by the Sitka Planning and Zoning Commission. SJ President David Dobler says anything that is planned for the future hinges on that master plat approval.
We really have to go through the hoops and do the marketing and close those deals that are going to, you know, generate sufficient cash to settle the debt. That is really the first That is the first commitment of the board, is settle all the debt.
The Board of Trustees has now acknowledged that Sheldon Jackson College is not likely to have the resources to reopen and run an educational institution, but it is seeking coordination with local entities to try and market the core facility in line with SJ's values related to Native culture and community benefits. Ultimately, Dobler says the hope is that the state of Alaska will step in and provide support. He says in the past year, they've talked to various agencies within state government, specifically Department of Labor and the Department of Education, as well as the Department of Public Safety, about some sort of training or educational facility on the core campus. But he says there needs to be support from the city to gain credibility in Juneau.
So the idea is if the community of Sitka could say to the state and to our representatives, we think it would be a great idea for some sort of educational, you know, conglomerate or whatever to be on this campus, and we think it's likely to be some part of the state government. We would like a united front in saying that, so that from Juneau's perspective, they said, well, the community is on board with this, and the various groups are, you know, have worked out things within Sitka, so that we don't have to pick favorites if we're going to work with getting something done there.
Beyond that, the group discussed what some of the educational and training opportunities could be for the core property. Karen Martinson of the Sitka Education Consortia reminded everyone that the Sitka Comprehensive Plan has an education section that would fit with some kind of vocational training center.
And the education section to this day still says that Sitka will provide support for the development of a vocational institute as economic development for Sitka that will work with the city, the economic and community groups to develop Sitka as an educational hub and to strengthen what we already had. So it also speaks to a number of career, workforce, and technical education. That is our comprehensive plan.
Martinson points to a new AGEA strategic plan put out by the State of Alaska Labor and Workforce Development, which identifies career training opportunities needed in the state in preparation for an Alaska gas line. Martinson says a VOTEC center similar to Seward's AVTEC Marine Training Program or the Job Center in Wasilla would be an attractive option, not just for Sitka, but all of Southeast.
In a nutshell, I would suggest that the state does have a huge need. They have 4,000 to 5,000 dropouts per year in Alaska, mostly rural students. There is nowhere for them to go, with the exception of some of the regional centers or the Job Corps. There's nothing in Southeast if you have not finished your diploma and you're working on a GED.
Martinson says the AGEA plan identifies 113 key positions that will be available in the future. Those in attendance seem to favor some kind of cultural and educational training facility, and Trustee Gary Paxton says the next step is to show the state and federal government that there is community support from both a consortium of stakeholders as well as the City Assembly. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Eileen Good in Dillingham, Casey Kelly in Kodiak, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com. And by
Tech Cominco and the Red Dog Mine, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Check your local public radio station for airtimes.
Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at APRN.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.